The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with an article from the books section of the March 25th, 2024 issue of the New Yorker magazine. The Forgotten History of Hitler's Establishment Enablers. The Nazi leader didn't seize power, he was given it, by Adam Gopnik. Hitler is so fully imagined a subject, so obsessively present on our televisions and in our bookstores, that to reimagine him seems pointless. As with the Hollywood fascination with Charles Manson, speculative curiosity gives retrospective glamour to evil. Hitler created a world in which women were transported with their children for days in closed train cars, and then had to watch those children die alongside them, naked, gasping for breath in a gas chamber. To ask whether the man responsible for this was motivated by reading Oswald Spengler or merely by meeting him seems to attribute too much complexity of purpose to him, not to mention posthumous dignity. Yet, allowing the specifics of his ascent to be clouded by disdain is not much better than allowing his memory to be ennobled by mystery. So the historian Timothy W. Rybak's choice to make his new book, Takeover, Hitler's Final Rise to Power, published by Knopf, an aggressively specific chronicle of a single year, 1932, seems a wise, even an inspired one. Rybak details, week by week, day by day, and sometimes hour by hour, how a country with a functional, if flawed, democratic machinery handed absolute power over to someone who could never claim a majority in an actual election, and whom the entire conservative political class regarded as a chaotic clown with a violent following. Rybak shows how major players thought that they could find some ulterior advantage in managing him. Each was sure that, after the passing of a brief storm cloud, so obviously overloaded that it had to expend itself, they would emerge in possession of power. The corporate bosses thought that if you looked past the strutting and the performative anti-Semitism, you had someone who would protect your money. Communist ideologues thought that if you peered deeply enough into the strutting and the performative anti-Semitism, you could spy the pattern of a popular revolution. The decent right thought that he was too obviously deranged to remain in power long. And the decent left, tempered by earlier fights against different enemies, thought that if they forcibly stuck to the rule of law, then the law would somehow by itself entrap a lawless leader. In a now familiar paradox, the rational forces stuck to magical thinking, while the irrational ones were more logical, parsing the brute equations of power. And so the storm never passed. In a way, it still has not. Rybak's story begins soon after Hitler's very incomplete victory in the Weimar Republic's parliamentary elections of July 1932. Hitler's party, the National Socialist German Workers' Party, its German initials were NSDAP, emerged with 37% of the vote and 230 out of 608 seats in the Reichstag, the German parliament, substantially ahead of any of its rivals. In the normal course of events, this would have led the aging warrior Paul von Hindenburg, Germany's president, to appoint Hitler chancellor, the equivalent of prime minister in other parliamentary systems. The chancellor was meant to answer to his party, to the Reichstag, and to the president, who appointed him and who could remove him. Yet, both Hindenburg and the sitting chancellor, Franz von Papen, had been firm, never Hitler men, and naively entreated Hitler to recognize his own unsuitability for the role. The NSDAP had been in existence since right after World War I. As one of many Volkisch, or populist groups, its label, by including national and socialist, was intended to appeal to both right-wing nationalists and left-wing socialists, who were thought to share a common enemy, the elite class of Jewish bankers who, they said, manipulated Germany behind the scenes and had been responsible for the German surrender. The Nazis, as they were called, a put-down made into a popular label like Impressionists, began as one of the many fringe and populist anti-Semitic groups in Germany, including the Thule Society, which was filled with bizarre pre-QAnon conspiracy adepts. Hitler, an Austrian corporal with a toothbrush mustache, when Charlie Chaplin first saw him in newsreels, he assumed Hitler was aping his Little Tramp character, had seized control of the party in 1921. Then a failed attempt at a push in Munich in 1923 left him in prison, but with many comforts, much respect, and paper and time with which to write his memoir, Mein Kampf. He re-emerged as the leader of all the nationalists fighting for election, with an accompanying paramilitary organization, the Sturmabteilung, S.A., under the direction of the more or less openly homosexual Ernst Röhm, and a press office under the direction of Joseph Goebbels. In the American style, the press office recognized the political significance of the era's new technology and social media, exploiting sound recordings, newsreels, and radio, and even having Hitler campaign by airplane. Hitler's plans were deliberately ambiguous, but his purposes were not. Ever since his unsuccessful putsch in Munich, he had, Ryback writes, been driven by a single ambition to destroy the political system that he held responsible for the myriad ills plaguing the German people. Ryback skips past the underlying mechanics of the July 1932 election on the way to his real subject, Hitler's manipulation of the conservative politicians and tycoons who thought they were manipulating him. But there's a notable academic literature on what actually happened when Germans voted that summer. The political scientists and historians who study it tell us that the election was a, quote, normal one, in the sense that the behavior of groups and subgroups proceeded in the usual way, responding more to the perception of political interest than to some convulsions of apocalyptic feeling. The popular picture of the decline of the Weimar Republic, in which hyperinflation produced mass unemployment, which produced an unstoppable wave of fascism, is far from the truth. The hyperinflation had ended in 1923, and the period right afterward in the mid-20s was, in Germany, as elsewhere, golden. The financial crash of 1929 certainly energized the parties of the far left and the far right. Still, the results of the July 1932 election weren't obviously catastrophic. The Nazis came out as the largest single party, but both Hitler and Goebbels were bitterly disappointed by their standing. The unemployed actually opposed Hitler and voted en masse for the parties of the left. Hitler won the support of self-employed people who were in decent economic shape but felt that their lives and livelihoods were threatened, of rural Protestant voters and of domestic workers, still a sizable group, perhaps because they felt unsafe outside a rigid hierarchy. What was once called the petite bourgeoisie then was key to his support, not people feeling the brunt of economic precarity, but people feeling the possibility of it. Having nothing to fear but fear itself is having something significant to fear. It was indeed a normal election in that respect, responding not least to the outburst of normal politics with which Hitler had littered his program. He had, in the months beforehand, damped down his usual ranting about Jews and bankers and moneyed elites and the rest. He had recorded a widely distributed phonograph album, the era's equivalent of a podcast, designed to make him seem, well, chancellorish. He emphasized agricultural support and a return to better times, aiming, as Ryback writes, to bridge divides of class and conscience, socialism and nationalism. By the strange alchemy of demagoguery, a brief visit to the surface of sanity annulled years and years of crazy. The Germans were voting, in the absent-minded way of democratic voters everywhere, for easy reassurances, for stability, with classes siding against their historical enemies. They weren't wild-eyed nationalists voting for a millennial authoritarian regime that would rule forever and restore Germany to glory, and certainly they weren't voting for an apocalyptic nightmare that would leave tens of millions of people dead and the cities of Germany destroyed. They were voting for specific programs that they thought would benefit them and for a year's insurance against the people they feared. Ryback spends most of his time with two pillars of respectable conservative Germany, General Kurt von Schleicher and the right-wing media magnate Alfred Hugenberg. Utterly contemptuous of Hitler as a lazy buffoon, he didn't wake up until 11 most mornings and spent much of his time watching and talking about movies, the two men still hated the communists and even the center-left Social Democrats more than they did anyone on the right. And they spent most of 1932 and 1933 scheming to use Hitler as a stalking horse for their own ambitions. Schleicher is perhaps first among Ryback's too clever for their own good villains, and the book presents a piercingly novelistic picture of him. Though in some ways a classic Prussian militarist, Schleicher, like so many of the German upper classes, was also a cultivated and cosmopolitan bon vivant, whom the well-connected journalist and diarist Bella Fromm called a man of almost irresistible charm. He was a character out of a Jean Renoir film, the regretful junker caught in modern times. He had no illusions about Hitler. "What am I to do with that psychopath?" he said after hearing about his behavior. But infinitely ambitious, he thought that Hitler's call for strongman rule might awaken the German people to the need for a real strongman, i.e. Schleicher. Ryback tells us that Schleicher had a strategy he dubbed the Sachenprozess, or taming process, which was meant to sideline the radicals of the Nazi Party and bring the movement into mainstream politics. He publicly commended Hitler as a modest, orderly man who only wants what is best and who would follow the rule of law. He praised Hitler's paramilitary troops, too, defending them against press reports of street violence. In fact, as Ryback explains, the game plan was to have the brown shirts crush the forces of the left, and then to have the regular German army crush the brown shirts. Schleicher imagined himself a master manipulator of men and causes. He liked to play with a menagerie of glass animal figurines on his desk, leaving the impression that lesser beings were mere toys to be handled. In June of 1932, he prevailed on Hindenburg to give the chancellorship to Papen, a weak politician widely viewed as Schleicher's puppet. Papen, in turn, installed Schleicher as Minister of Defense. Then they dissolved the Reichstag and held those July elections, which predictably gave the Nazis a big boost. Rybak spends many mordant pages tracking Schleicher's whirling dervish intrigues as he tries to realize his fantasy of the Zahmungsprozess. Many of these involve schemes shared with the patriotic and staunchly anti-Nazi General Kurt von Hammerstein Equord, familiar to viewers of Babylon Berlin as Major General Seegers. Hammerstein was one of the few German officers to fully grasp Hitler's real nature. At a meeting with Hitler in the spring of 1932, Hammerstein told him bluntly, "Herr Hitler, if you achieve power legally, that would be fine with me. If the circumstances are different, I will use arms." He later felt reassured when Hindenburg intimated that if the Nazi paramilitary troops acted, he could order the army to fire on them. Yet, Hammerstein remained impotent. At various moments, Schleicher, as the Minister of Defense, entertained what was in effect a plan for imposing martial law with himself in charge and Hammerstein at his side. In retrospect, it was the last hope of protecting the Republic from Hitler. But after President Hindenburg rejected it, not out of democratic misgivings, but out of suspicion of Schleicher's purposes, Hammerstein, an essentially tragic figure, was unable to act alone. He suffered from a malady found among decent military men suddenly thrust into positions of political power. His scruples were at odds with his habits of deference to hierarchy. Generals became generals by learning to take orders before they learned how to give them. Hammerstein hated Hitler, but he waited for someone else of impeccable authority to give a clear direction before he would act. He went on waiting right through the war as part of the equally impotent military nexus that wanted Hitler dead, but, until it was too late, lacked the will to kill him. The extra parliamentary actions that were fleetingly contemplated in the months after the election, a war in the streets, or more likely a civil confrontation leading to a military coup, seemed horrific. The trouble, unknowable to the people of the time, is that since what did happen is the worst thing that has ever happened, any alternative would have been less horrific. One wants to shout to Hammerstein and his cohorts, "Go ahead, take over the government, arrest Hitler and his henchmen, rule for a few years and then try again. It won't be as bad as what happens next." But of course they cannot hear us. They couldn't have heard us then. Rybak's gift for detail joins with a nice feeling for the black comedy of the period. He makes much sport of the attempts by foreign journalists resident in Germany, particularly the New York Times' Frederick T. Birchall, to normalize the Nazi ascent, with Birchall continually reassuring his leaders that Hitler, an out-of-his-depth simpleton, was not the threat he seemed to be, and that the other conservatives were far more potent in their political maneuvering. When Papen made a speech denying that Hitler's paramilitary forces represented the German nation, Birchall wrote that the speech contained dynamite enough to change completely the political situation in the Reich. On another occasion, Birchall wrote that the Hitlerites were deluded to think that they hold the best cards. There was every reason to think that the big cards, the ones that will really decide the game, were in the hands of people such as Papen, Hindenburg, and above all, Schleicher. Rybak, focusing on the self-entrapped German conservatives, generally avoids the question that seems most obvious to a contemporary reader. Why was a coalition between the moderate left, Social Democrats, and the conservative but far from Nazified Catholic centrists never even seriously attempted? Given that Hitler had repeatedly vowed to use the democratic process in order to destroy democracy, why did the people committed to democracy let him do it? Many historians have jousted with this question, but perhaps the most piercing account remains an early one, written less than a decade after the war by the emigre German scholar Louis Edinger, who had known the leaders of the Social Democrats well and consulted them directly. The ones who had survived, that is, for his study. His conclusion was that they simply trusted that constitutional processes and the return of reason and fair play would assure the survival of the Weimar Republic and its chief supporters. The Social Democratic leadership had become a gerontocracy, out of touch with the generational changes beneath them. The top Social Democratic leaders were on average 2 decades older than their Nazi counterparts. Worse, the Social Democrats remained in the grip of a long struggle with Bismarckian nationalism, which, however oppressive it might have been, still operated with a broad idea of legitimacy and the rule of law. The institutional procedures of parliamentarianism had always seen the Social Democrats through. Why would those procedures not continue to protect them? In a battle between demagoguery and democracy, surely democracy had the advantage. Edinger writes that Karl Kautsky, among the most eminent of the party's theorists, believed that after the election, Hitler supporters would realize he was incapable of fulfilling his promises and drift away. The Social Democrats may have been hobbled, too, by their commitment to team leadership, which meant that no single charismatic individual represented them. Proceduralists and institutionalists by temperament and training, they were, as Edinger demonstrates, unable to imagine the nature of their adversary. They acceded to Hitler's assent with the belief that by respecting the rules themselves, they would encourage the other side to play by them as well. Even after Hitler consolidated his power, he was seen to have secured the chancellorship by constitutional means. Edinger quotes Arnold Brecht, a fellow exiled statesman, "To rise against him on the first night would make the rebels the technical violators of the Constitution that they wanted to defend." Meanwhile, the centrist Catholics, whom Hitler shrewdly recognized as his most formidable potential adversaries, were handicapped in any desire to join with the Democratic Socialists by their fear of the Communists. Though the Communists had previously made various alliances of convenience with the Social Democrats, by 1932 they were tightly controlled by Stalin, who had ordered them to depict the Social Democrats as being as great a threat to the working class as Hitler. And when a rumor spread that Hitler had once spat out a communion host, it only made him more popular among Catholics, since it called attention to his Catholic upbringing. Indeed, most attempts to highlight Hitler's personal depravities, including his possible sexual relationship with his niece Geli, which was no secret in the press of the time. Her apparent suicide, less than a year before the election, had been a tabloid scandal, made him more popular. In any case, Hitler was skilled at reassuring the Catholic center, promising to be the strong protector of Christianity as the basis of our common moral order. Hitler's hatred of parliamentary democracy, even more than his hatred of Jews, was central to his identity, Ryback emphasizes. Antisemitism was a regular feature of populist politics in the region. Hitler had learned much of it in his youth from the Vienna mayor Karl Luger. But Luger was a genuine populist democrat who brought universal male suffrage to the city. Hitler's originality lay elsewhere. Unlike Hitler's anti-Semitism, a toxic brew of pseudoscientific readings and malignant mentoring, Hitler's hatred of the Weimar Republic was the result of personal observation of political processes, Ryback writes. He hated the haggling and compromise of coalition politics inherent in multi-party political systems. second only to Schleicher in Rybak's accounting of Hitler's establishment enablers, is the media magnate Alfred Hugenberg. The owner of the country's leading film studio and of the National News Service, which supplied some 1,600 newspapers, he was far from an admirer. He regarded Hitler as manic and unreliable, but found him essential for the furtherance of their common program, and was in and out of political alliance with him during the crucial year. Hugenberg had begun constructing his media empire in the late 19-teens in response to what he saw as the bias against conservatives in much of the German press, and he shared Hitler's hatred of democracy and of the Jews. But he thought of himself as a much more sophisticated player and intended to use his control of modern media in pursuit of what he called a katastrophischen Politik, a catastrophe politics of cultural warfare in which the strategy, Rybak says, was to flood the public space with inflammatory news stories, half-truths, rumors, and outright lies. The aim was to polarize the public and to crater anything like consensus. Hugenberg gave Hitler money as well as publicity, but Hugenberg had his own political ambitions, somewhat undermined by a personal aura described by his nickname, Der Hamster, and his own party, and Hitler was furiously jealous of the spotlight. While giving Hitler support in his media, a support sometimes interrupted by impatience, Hugenberg urged him to act rationally and settle for Nazi positions in the cabinet if he could not have the chancellorship. What strengthened the Nazis throughout the conspiratorial maneuverings of the period was certainly not any great display of discipline. The Nazi movement was a chaotic mess of struggling in-groups who feared and despised one another. Hitler rightly mistrusted the loyalty even of his chief lieutenant, Gregor Strasser, who fell on the socialist side of the National Socialist label. The members of the SA, the stormtroopers, meanwhile, were loyal mainly to their own leader, Ernst Röhm, and embarrassed Hitler with their run of sexual scandals. The NSDAP was a hive of internal antipathies that could resolve only in violence, a condition that would endure to the last weeks of the war, when, standing amid the ruins of Germany, Hitler was enraged to discover that Heinrich Himmler was trying to negotiate a separate peace with the Western Allies. The strength of the Nazis lay, rather, in the curiously enclosed and benumbed character of their leader. Hitler was impossible to discourage, not because he ran an efficient machine, but because he was immune to the normal human impediments to absolute power: shame, calculation, or even a desire to see a particular political program put in place. Hindenburg, knowing of Hitler's genuinely courageous military service in World War I, appealed in their meetings to his patriotism, his love of the fatherland. But Hitler, an Austrian who did not receive German citizenship until shortly before the 1932 election, did not love the fatherland. He ran on the hydrogen fuel of pure hatred. He did not want power in order to implement a program. He wanted power in order to realize his pain. A fascinating and once classified document prepared for the precursor of the CIA, the OSS, by the psychoanalyst Walter Langer used first-person accounts to gauge the scale of Hitler's narcissism. He wrote, "It may be of interest to note at this time that of all the titles that Hitler might have chosen for himself, he is content with the simple one of Führer. To him, this title is the greatest of them all. He has spent his life searching for a person worthy of the role, but was unable to find one until he discovered himself." Or, as the acute Hungarian-American historian John Lukacs, who spent a lifetime studying Hitler's psychology, observed, his hatred for his opponents was both stronger and less abstract than was his love for his people. That was and remains a distinguishing mark of the mind of every extreme nationalist. In November of 1932, one more Reichstag election was held. Once again, it was a bitter disappointment to Hitler and Goebbels. A disaster, as Goebbels declared on election night. An earlier presidential election had also reaffirmed Hindenburg over the Hitler movement. The Nazi wave that everyone had expected failed to materialize. The Nazis lost seats, and once again, they could not crack 50%. The Times explained that the Hitler movement had passed its high water mark and that, quote, the country is getting tired of the Nazis, end quote. Everywhere, Ryback says, the cartoonist and editorialist delighted in Hitler's discomfiture. One cartoonist showed him presiding over a graveyard of swastikas. In December of 1932, having lost three elections in a row, Hitler seemed to be finished. The subsequent maneuverings are as dispiriting to read about as they are exhausting to follow. Basically, Schleicher conspired to have Papen fired as chancellor by Hindenburg and replaced by himself. He calculated that he could cleave Gregor Strasser and the more respectable elements of the Nazis from Hitler, form a coalition with them, and leave Hitler on the outside looking in. But Papen, a small man in everything except his taste for revenge, turned on Schleicher in a rage and went directly to Hitler, proposing, despite his earlier Never Hitler views, that they form their own coalition. Schleicher's plan to spirit Strasser away from Hitler and break the Nazi Party in two then stumbled on the reality that the real base of the party was fanatically loyal only to its leader. And Strasser, knowing this, refused to leave the party, even as he conspired with Schleicher to undermine it. Then, in mid-January, a small regional election in Lipperland took place. Though the results were again disappointing for Hitler and Goebbels, the National Socialist German Workers' Party still hadn't surmounted the 50% mark. They managed to sell the election as a kind of triumph. At party meetings, Hitler denounced Strasser. The idea, much beloved by Schleicher and his allies, of breaking a Strasser ring of the party off from Hitler became obviously impossible. Hindenburg, in his mid-80s and growing weak, became fed up with Schleicher's Machiavellian stratagems and dispensed with him as chancellor. Papen, dismissed not long before, was received by the president. He promised that he could form a working majority in the Reichstag by simple means. Hindenburg should go ahead and appoint Hitler chancellor. Hitler, he explained, had made significant concessions and could be controlled. He would want only the chancellorship and not more seats in the cabinet. What could go wrong? Hindenburg reportedly asked, "You mean to tell me I have the unpleasant task of appointing this Hitler as the next chancellor?" He did. The conservative strategists celebrated their victory. "So we box Hitler in," Hugenberg said confidently. Papen crowed, "Within 2 months we will have pressed Hitler into our corner so tight that he'll squeak." The big joke on democracy is that it gives its mortal enemies the tools to its own destructions, Goebbels said as the Nazis rose to power. One of those quotes that sound apocryphal, but are not. The ultimate fates of Ryback's players are varied and instructive. Schleicher, the conservative who saw right through Hitler's weakness, who had found a way to entrap him and then use him against the left, was killed by the stormtroopers during the Night of the Long Knives in 1934, when Hitler consolidated his hold over his own movement by murdering his less loyal lieutenants. Strasser and Röhm were murdered then too. Hitler's and Goebbels, of course, died by their own hands in defeat, having left tens of millions of Europeans dead and their country in ruins. But Hugenberg, sidelined during the Third Reich, was exonerated by a denazification court in the years after the war. And Papen, who had ushered Hitler directly into power, was acquitted at Nuremberg. In the 1950s, he was awarded the highest honorary order of the Catholic Church. Does history have patterns or merely circumstances and unique contingencies? Certainly, the Germany of 1932 was a place unto itself. The truth that some cycles may recur, but inexactly, is best captured in that fine aphorism, "History does not repeat itself, but it sometimes rhymes." Appropriately, no historian is exactly sure who said this. Widely credited to Mark Twain, it was more likely first said long after his death. We see through a glass darkly, as patterns of authoritarian ambition seem to flash before our eyes. The demagogue made strong not by conviction, but by being numb to normal human encouragements and admonitions. The aging center-left, the media lords who want something like what the demagogue wants, but in the end are controlled by him. The political maneuverers who think they can outwit the demagogue. The resistance and sudden surrender. Democracy doesn't die in darkness. It dies in bright mid-afternoon light, where politicians fall back on familiarities and make faint offers to authoritarians and say a firm and final no, and then wake up a few days later and say, "Well, maybe this time it might all work out, and look at the other side." Precise circumstances never repeat, yet shapes and patterns so often recur. In history, it's true. The same thing never happens twice, but the same things do. Next, from the March 15th, 2024 online edition of The New Yorker, "Why is the sea so hot? A startling rise in sea surface temperatures suggests that we may not understand how fast the climate is changing," by Elizabeth Colbert. In early 2023, climate scientists and anyone else paying attention to the data started to notice something strange. At the beginning of March, sea surface temperatures began to rise. By April, they'd set a new record. The average temperatures at the surface of the world's oceans, excluding those at the poles, was just a shade under 70 degrees. Typically, the highest sea surface temperatures of the year are observed in March, toward the end of the Southern Hemisphere's summer. Last year, temperatures remained abnormally high through the Southern Hemisphere's autumn and beyond, breaking the monthly records for May, June, July, and other months. The North Atlantic was particularly bathtub-like. In the words of Copernicus, an arm of the European Union Space Service, temperatures in the basin were, quote, "off the charts," end quote. Since the start of 2024, sea surface temperatures have continued to climb. In February, they set yet another record. In a warming world, ocean temperatures are expected to rise and keep on rising. But for the last 12 months, the seas have been so feverish that scientists are starting to worry about not just the physical impacts of all that heat, but the theoretical implications. Can the past year be explained by what's already known about climate change? Or are there forces at work that haven't been accounted for? And if it's the latter, Does this mean that projections of warming, already decidedly grim, are underestimating the dangers? We don't really know what's going on, Gavin Schmidt, the director of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies, told me, and we haven't really known what's going on since about March of last year. He called the situation disquieting. Last winter, before the ocean temperatures began their record run, the world was in the cool, or La Niña, phase of a climate pattern that goes by the acronym ENSO. By summer, an El Niño, or warm phase, had begun. Since ocean temperatures started to climb before the start of El Niño, the shift by itself seems insufficient to account for what's going on. Meanwhile, the margin by which records are being shattered exceeds what's usually seen during El Niños. Brian McNulty, a hurricane researcher at the University of Miami, said, "It's not like we're breaking records by a little bit now and then. It's like the whole climate just fast-forwarded by 50 or 100 years. That's how strange this looks." It's estimated that in 2023, the heat content in the upper 2,000 meters of the oceans increased by at least 9 zettajoules. For comparison's sake, the world's annual energy consumption amounts to about 0.6 zettajoules. A variety of circumstances and events have been cited as possible contributors to the past year's anomalous warmth. One is the January 2022 eruption of an underwater volcano in the South Pacific called Hunga Tonga, Hunga Aapai. Usually volcanoes emit sulfur dioxide, which produces a temporary cooling effect, and water vapor, which does the opposite. Hunga Tonga, Hunga Aapai produce relatively little sulfur dioxide, but a fantastic amount of water vapor, and its warming effects, it's believed, are still being felt. Another factor is the current solar cycle, known as Solar Cycle 25. Solar activity is ramping up. It's expected to peak this year or next. And this, too, may be producing an extra bit of warming. Yet, another is a change in the composition of shipping fuel. Regulations that went into effect in 2020 reduce the amount of sulfur in the fuel used by supertankers. This reduction, in turn, has led to a decline in a type of air pollution that, through direct and indirect effects, reflects sunlight back to space. It's thought that this change has led to an increase in the amount of energy being absorbed by the seas, though quantifying the effect is difficult. Can all of these factors together account for what's going on? Climate scientists say it's possible. There's also a lot of noise in the climate system. This could end up just being natural variability. Susan Wichtels, a senior scientist at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, says. But possibly something else is going on, something that scientists haven't yet accounted for. This spring, ENSO is expected to transition into what scientists call neutral conditions. If precedent holds, then when this occurs, ocean temperatures should start to run more in line with long-term trends. Wichtels said, "I think the real test will be what happens in the next 12 months. If temperatures remain very high, then I would say more people in the community will be really alarmed and say, okay, this is outside of what we can explain." In 2023, which was by far the warmest year on record on land, as well as in the oceans, many countries experienced record-breaking heat waves or record-breaking wildfires or record-breaking rainstorms or some combination of these. Last year in the United States, there were 28 weather-related disasters that caused more than $1 billion worth of damage, another record. If the climate projections are accurate, then the year was a preview of things to come, which is scary enough. But if the projections are missing something, that's potentially even more terrifying, though scientists tend to use more measured terms. Schmidt observed that the other thing that this could all be is we are starting to see shifts in how the system responds. All of these statistics that we're talking about, they're taken from the prior data. But nothing in the prior data looked like 2023. Does that mean that the prior data are no longer predictive because the system has changed? I can't rule that out, and that would obviously be very concerning. And now, from the March 25th, 2024 issue of the New Yorker, how foreign policy became a campaign issue for 2024. This year, looking at Gaza and Ukraine, what happens in the rest of the world seems to matter a bit more than usual to Americans, by Benjamin Wallace Wells. Presidential elections rarely hinge on issues of foreign policy, yet candidates delight in them. The lure is the scale. Spot a political pattern emerging across the globe, pin its fortunes to yours, Clinton's third-way neoliberalism, Reagan's cheerily fierce anti-communism, and your legacy might reach far beyond Washington, your ideas imprinted in the hearts of billions. Donald Trump praised foreign autocrats so frequently. Xi Jinping is, quote, smart, brilliant, everything perfect, end quote. Kim Jong-un is a, quote, tough, smart guy, end quote. That he seemed to envision them as strongman pals. John Kelly, Trump's former chief of staff, recently told CNN's Jim Sciutto that the ex-president had mused repeatedly that Adolf Hitler, quote, did some good things, unquote, and commanded, quote, loyalty, end quote. Kelly had to break the news that the Führer's own officers tried, on several occasions, to disloyally assassinate him. But this year, what happens in the rest of the world seems to matter a bit more than usual to Americans. A recent AP-NORC poll found that, compared with a year ago, twice as many voters, taking in the grinding war in Ukraine and the ferocious Israeli military offensive in Gaza, see foreign policy as a top national priority. Trump has been largely quiet on Israel, drawing a sharper contrast with Biden over Ukraine. He played host at Mar-a-Lago to Viktor Orban, the Hungarian prime minister and Vladimir Putin's ally, and told the crowd at a New Hampshire rally that he'd encourage Putin's Russia to, quote, do whatever the hell they want, end quote, to any NATO member that, in his estimation, didn't pay a sufficient share for mutual defense. As Trump's influence has grown and Senator Mitch McConnell's has waned, the Ukraine issue has become polarized. A majority of Americans support giving further aid, but more than half of Republicans think we've given enough. At Trump's behest, House Speaker Mike Johnson is refusing to bring to the floor Senate-approved weapons funding that Kiev badly needs. Putin has noticed the delay, saying last week, it would be ridiculous for us to negotiate with Ukraine just because it's running out of ammunition. Given all this, the White House has been working assiduously to make foreign issues the accelerator pedal for its idling re-election campaign. Biden opened his widely praised State of the Union address by linking the military defense of Ukraine against Putin to the electoral defense of American democracy against Trumpism. Biden said, "What makes our moment rare is that freedom and democracy are under attack, both at home and overseas," at the very same time. The Ukraine issue has tended to show Biden at his best, since it at once demonstrates the necessity of his anti-authoritarianism and showcases his sometimes sentimental idealism. His best line in the address took aim at Trump when he said, "You can't love your country only when you win." But efforts to position Biden as a champion of democracy have been complicated by his support of Israel's war in Gaza, whose opponents have followed him on the campaign trail. 2 days after the State of the Union, at a Georgia rally intended to build on the momentum, Biden had barely begun his remarks when a man in the audience shouted, "You're a dictator, Genocide Joe! Tens of thousands of Palestinians are dead. Children are dying." Biden supporters tried to drown out the protesters with boos while the president tried to keep the peace. "Wait, wait, wait," he said, motioning for calm. But the point had been made. It has been made elsewhere even more emphatically. Last month in the presidential primary in the crucial state of Michigan, 13% of Democrats, including majorities in three heavily Arab American cities, voted uncommitted, reminding everyone that defections by voters over the issue of Gaza could tip the race toward Trump. Biden's foreign policy approach has been centrally about friends, about backing our allies. And after the horrifying attacks of October 7th, the president traveled to Israel, where he embraced Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and told the Israel people, "You are not alone." The idea, Biden's advisors made clear, was to keep Netanyahu close enough to restrain him. So Biden chose to continue sending military aid to Israel rather than condition or restrict it, and to veto a UN resolution calling for an immediate humanitarian ceasefire. The offensive in Gaza has been unstinting, killing upward of 30,000 Palestinians, more than 10,000 of them children, and the deaths have had an effect in the U.S. According to Gallup, half of Americans think that the offensive has gone too far, and the number who viewed Israel favorably, though it's still high at 58%, is at its lowest in more than two decades. Biden himself seems to be growing more disturbed by the crisis, in particular by Israel's threat of an imminent invasion of Rafah, the city in southern Gaza, where more than a million Palestinians are sheltering. Secretary of State Antony Blinken called for an immediate and sustained ceasefire of at least 6 weeks. And Biden directed the Pentagon to begin building a floating pier in the eastern Mediterranean to try to get aid supplies to Palestinians. Caught on a hot mic after the State of the Union, Biden said he'd told Netanyahu that they would soon have a, quote, come to Jesus, end quote, moment. Perhaps the persistence of uncommitted votes, 8% of Democrats in Washington State's primary, 19% in Minnesota's, and 29% in Hawaii's caucuses, is helping nudge the party toward a new view. Last week, Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said on the Senate floor that Netanyahu had become an, quote, obstacle to peace, end quote. "It is time," he said, "for new leadership in Israel." The challenge for Biden in this conflict has been understood as one of balance, of not tipping too far either toward the pro-Israeli center or toward the pro-Palestinian left, and thus alienating the other. But perhaps the bigger risk, especially acute for an 81-year-old president, is the perception that he is losing control of a situation overseas. During the pullout from Afghanistan, perhaps a moment when Biden's approval ratings began to tip in the wrong directions, Republicans effectively attacked him as being asleep at the wheel of a chaotic world. They are now trying the same maneuver with the southern border. A spring of disorder looms, not only in Gaza, but also in Ukraine, with concerns that Russia is positioning for a renewed offensive, and in Haiti, whose prime minister has announced his resignation, unable to return to a country largely controlled by gangs. In the fall, voters will have their say. Biden and the Democrats seem to be coming to the view that, by then, they will be judged not just on where their affinities lie, but on how effectively they can safeguard order. Next, a poem from the March 25th, 2024 issue, Untitled, by Nasser Rabah, translated from the Arabic by Imna Zaghal, Khalid Al-Hili, and Amil Al-Khalay for the Brooklyn Translation Collective. December 30, 2023. And a day goes by. And tanks. And the sky a festival of kids flying kites. And blood flowed behind a panting car. And a day goes by. And the planes. And the tent of the displaced makes a bet with time. Winter is late. And a day goes by. And the snipers. And the market itself has no salt. So I said, no worries. The merchants have plenty of sadness. And a day goes by, and artillery. But my neighbor's funeral passes along, slowly. Why rush at a time like this? And a day goes by, and the newscasts. And when evening came, it was a bit joyous to find us all there with none missing, except the house. We've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.